This is Ron Stockton. Have you ever read the poem Evangeline by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow? He wrote it in 1847. I guess that's a rhetorical question because I know the answer. Unless you are my age or are a very unusual person, you have never read anything by Longfellow. Of course, you may recognize some famous lines from his poems. 'Twas the 18th of April in 75, hardly a man is now alive who remembers that fateful day and year. One if by land and two if by sea, and I on the opposite shore will be, ready and waiting to spread the alarm to every Middlesex village and farm. Or, under the spreading chestnut tree the village smithy stands, the smith, a mighty man is he, with large and sinewy hands. Or, by the shores of Getchigumi, by the shining Big Sea water, stood the wigwam of Nokomis. When I was a kid, back in the 50s, all of us knew those lines. Well, a lot of us knew some of them. Today, I suspect almost none of you know any of those lines. Some of you may know Longfellow's Christmas song, I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day, although I doubt you know that Longfellow is the author. He wrote it in 1863 in the depths of despair. His beloved wife had been burned to death in 1861 when her dress caught on fire. Longfellow suffered serious facial scarring trying to save her. That's why he grew a beard, to conceal the deformity. Then his son had been seriously wounded in the Civil War and was disabled. And that war seemed to be going on forever. He wasn't sure if it was worth getting up in the morning. But in 1863, he heard the bells on Christmas morning and somehow found the strength to regain his balance. Here's an excerpt from that amazing poem. It was put to music in 1872. And in despair I bowed my head. There is no peace on earth, I said, for hate is strong and mocks the song of peace on earth, goodwill to men. Then rang the bells more loud and deep. God is not dead, nor doth he sleep. The wrong shall fail, the right prevail, with peace on earth, goodwill to men. Longfellow was the first American poet to have a bust in Westminster Abbey. He's buried in Mount Auburn Cemetery near Boston. That is America's first rural cemetery, if you know that term. It has been a tourist site from the day it was opened in 1831. I once spent 5 hours in that cemetery. I would have spent longer, but Jane was back at our hotel waiting for me to return. Longfellow's marker is a large block of marble, maybe 4 feet high and 6 feet long. It's very impressive. It was just a few years ago that I read Longfellow's most popular poem, Hiawatha. We were in Minneapolis and saw a statue of Hiawatha carrying the body of his beloved wife, Minnehaha. I decided I needed to read that poem. It was very nice. It had a somewhat sing-song rhythm, as someone called it, written as if it followed the beat of a tom-tom. Let me read you the opening, which captures the magic of that rhythm. Should you ask me whence these stories, whence these legends and traditions, with the odors of the forest, with the dew and damp of meadows, with the curling smoke of wigwams, with the rushing of great rivers, with their frequent repetitions and their wild reverberations, as of thunder in the mountains? I should answer, I should tell you, from the forests and the prairies, from the great lakes of the Northland, from the land of the Ojibways, from the land of the Dakotas, from the mountains, moors, and fenlands, where the heron, the shushuga, feeds among the reeds and rushes. I repeat them as I heard them, from the lips of Nawadaha, the musician, the sweet singer. And then there's the story of Nokomis, the grandmother of Hiawatha, who raised him. Nokomis was an honorable woman who warned her daughter Winona to beware of the west wind, a treacherous seducer of young women. But Winona did not listen. Let me read you a section. There among the ferns and mosses, there among the prairie lilies, on the muscadet, the meadow, in the moonlight and the starlight, fair Nokomis bore a daughter, and she called her name Winona, as the fair firstborn of her daughters. And the daughter of Nokomis grew up like the prairie lilies, grew a tall and slender maiden, with the beauty of the moonlight, with the beauty of the starlight. And Nokomis warned her often, saying oft and oft repeating, "Oh, beware of Mujikawas, of the west wing Mujikawas. Listen not to what he tells you. Lie not down upon the meadows. Stoop not down upon the lilies, lest the west wind come and harm you." But she heeded not the warning, heeded not those words of wisdom, and the west wind came at evening, walking lightly o'er the prairie, whispering to the leaves and blossoms, bending low the flowers and grasses, found the beautiful Winona lying there among the lilies, wooed her with his words of sweetness, wooed her with his soft caresses, till she bore a son in sorrow, bore a son of love and sorrow. Thus was born my Hiawatha, thus was born the child of wonder, but the daughter of Nokomis, Hiawatha's gentle mother, in her anguish died deserted by the west wing, false and faithless, by the heartless Mukjiwas. For her daughter long and loudly wailed and wept the sad Nokomis. "Oh, that I were dead," she murmured, "oh, that I were dead as thou art. No more work and no more weeping. Wahona, Wahona, by the shores of Gitchigumi, by the shining big sea water, stood the wigwam of Nokomis, daughter of the moon, Nokomis. Dark behind it rose the forest, rose the black and gloomy pine trees, rose the firs with cones upon them. Bright before it beat the water, beat the clear and sunny water, beat the shining big sea water. There the wrinkled old Nokomis nursed the little Hiawatha, rocked him in his linden cradle, bedded soft in moss and rushes, safely bound with reindeer sinews, stilled his fretful wail by saying, "Hush, the naked bear will hear thee," lulled him into slumber, singing, "Ewaya, my little owlet, who is this that lights the wigwams? With his great eyes lights the wigwams. Ewaya, my little owlet." I like that poem. Hiawatha was an honorable man, a courageous leader who did his best for his people. Still, I can see why it's out of favor. It sounds a bit like a white fantasy about Native American culture. Even when it came out, it was criticized. I think every educated person should be familiar with this poem, but I don't think it belongs in the curriculum. Evangeline is another matter. I read Evangeline in the eighth grade. It's an epic poem. It's not a poem in the sense of a rhyming poem, but in the sense of the Iliad. It is a long poem that tells a story that crosses decades. It is about the French Canadians who live in Acadia, which we today call Nova Scotia. At a certain point, King George decides that they are a security threat and should be moved to another place where they could not cause trouble. They are moved south to Louisiana, where they came to be known as Cajuns. The key person in the story is a beautiful young girl, Evangeline. Her father, Benedict Bellefontaine, a widower, is the most respected person in the village, and she is the most pious and virtuous and beautiful and desired young woman. All the young guys are gaga over her, but she has eyes only for Gabriel Lajeunesse. He is the son of Basil the blacksmith. Basil is also one of the most respected people in the village. We can see that this is going to be the most wonderful marriage in the history of this small paradise. And it is a paradise. Everyone owns land or has a role in society, so there are no distinctions of wealth or status. Everyone is assessed on the basis of their personal merit. And the two most meritorious families are about to be united in marriage by Father Felician, the beloved village priest. But there are storm clouds on the horizon. Some English ships have arrived. Exactly why they are there, no one is quite sure. Some people are terrified. France and England have been at war, and rumors spread of what might happen. But the village priest tells people to be calm. God is with them, and overreacting is not allowed. In the evening, the notary public appears at Benedict's house with Basil and Gabriel. They are there to sign the pre-marriage contract. There is much celebratory joy in this event. Little did they know that the next morning they will receive an evacuation order. The English captain announces their fate at a village gathering. He's not happy that he's been given this task. He carries out his duty with humanity, but still. These people are being evacuated from their homes. They are optimistic that as soon as tensions cool, they will be allowed to return. But as they leave, they see the fires of their homes as they are burned to the ground. They realize there will be no return. The men and the women are evacuated separately. Evangeline and Gabriel are separated. But they know they will reunite in their new home. This will be a place safely controlled by the French, so there will be no further threat from English ships. If those plans were true, there would have been no story to tell. Alas, Evangeline and Gabriel are separated. She waits for him to find her, then she goes off searching for him. This is to be a quest, a tragic quest that will take her the rest of her life. In their new home, she finds Gabriel's father, Basil, who says Gabriel was just there but left a few days ago. He is heading north to hunt but will return in the fall. When fall comes, he does not return. So she and the kindly priest head north looking for him. Once Evangeline and Gabriel are both on a river heading in opposite directions. They pass in the night. Anyone reading that line will want to jump up and shout, "Say something so your beloved one will recognize your voice and you will be united." But that does not happen. Evangeline ventures into Michigan and into the Moravian communities, Native American Christian pacifists. More than once she arrives just after Gabriel has left. It is as if fate had cursed them to be separated. A dear family friend comes by and urges her to choose another young man. The son of the notary public is a fine young man who has always had affection for her. He would make her happy and would give her children. But Evangeline is devoted to Gabriel and will not consider any other partner. The years pass. The decades pass. In time, Evangeline realizes her quest has been in vain. Perhaps Gabriel has even died. She decides to join an order of nuns who serve the poor. She comes to be known as a Sister of Mercy, who is always there for those who need comfort. In time, a terrible plague comes to her town. I take the city to be New Orleans. There was indeed a terrible fever in that area about that time. I've been to their graveyards and have seen the consequences of that epidemic. In the poem, there's an almshouse in Evangeline's town, a place where those impoverished and with no family to care for them go to die. Every day she goes to the almshouse to comfort the dying, to put water on their lips. One day she picks flowers to give to dying men so they will have something lovely as they pass into the next world. Inside the facility, she walks up to the bed of a living skeleton, a frail shadow of a person. She stops, stunned. Well, let me read it to you. Thus on the Sabbath morn, through the streets, deserted and silent, wending her quiet way, she entered the door of the almshouse. Sweet on the summer air was an odor of flowers in the garden, and she paused on her way to gather the fairest among them, that the dying once more might rejoice in their fragrance and beauty. Then as she mounted the stairs to the corridors, cooled by the east wind, distant and soft on her ear, fell the chimes from the belfry of Christ Church. While intermingled with these, across the meadow were wafted sounds of psalms that were sung by the Swedes in their church at Wakako. Soft as descending wings fell the calm of the hour on her spirit. Something within her said, "At length thy trials are ended." And with light in her looks, she entered the chambers of sickness, noiselessly moved about the assiduous, careful attendants, moistening the feverish lips and the aching brow, and in silence closing the sightless eyes of the dead and concealing their faces, where on their pallets they lay like drifts of snow by the roadside. Many a languid head upraised as Evangeline entered turned on its pillow of pain to gaze while she passed, for her presence fell on their hearts like a ray of sun on the walls of a prison. And as she looked around, she saw how Death, the consoler, laying his hand on many a heart, had healed it forever. Many familiar forms had disappeared in the nighttime. Vacant their places were, or filled already by strangers. Suddenly, as if arrested by fear or a feeling of wonder, still she stood with her colorless lips apart, while a shudder ran through her frame, and, forgotten, the flowerlets dropped from her fingers. And from her eyes and cheeks, the light and bloom of the morning, then there escaped from her lips a cry of such terrible anguish that the dying heard it and started up from their pillows. On the pallet before her was stretched the form of an old man, long and thin and gray with the locks that shaded his temples. But as he lay in the morning light, his face for a moment seemed to assume once more the forms of its earlier manhood. So are wont to be changed the faces of those who are dying. Hot and red on his lips still burned the flush of the fever, as if life, like the Hebrews, with blood had sprinkled its portals, that the angel of death might see the sign and pass over. Motionless, senseless, dying he lay, and his spirit exhausted seemed to be sinking down through the infinite depths of the darkness. Darkness of slumber and death forever sinking and sinking. Then, through those realms of shade in multiplied reverberations, heard he that cry of pain, and through the hush that succeeded, whispered a gentle voice, its accents tender and saint-like. Gabriel, my beloved, and died away into silence. Then he beheld, in a dream, once more the home of his childhood, green Acadia meadows, with sylvan rivers among them, village and mountain, and woodlands, and, walking under their shadow, as in the days of her youth, Evangeline rose in his vision. Tears came into his eyes, and as slowly he lifted his eyelids, vanished the vision away, but Evangeline knelt by his bedside. Vainly he strove to whisper her name, for the accents unuttered died on his lips, and their motion revealed what his tongue would have spoken. Vainly he strove to rise, and Evangeline, kneeling beside him, kissed his dying lips and laid his head on her bosom. Sweet was the light of his eyes, but it suddenly sank into darkness, as when a lamp is blown out by a gust of wind. All was ended now, the hope and the fear and the sorrow, all the aching of heart, the restless, unsatisfied longing, all the dull, deep pain and constant anguish of patience. And as she pressed once more the lifeless head to her bosom, meekly she bowed her own and murmured, "Father, I thank thee." Longfellow wrote an epilogue to this poem. It's just two stanzas. The first stanza is located in Louisiana. The second is located in Acadia. Let me read that to you. "Still stands the forest primeval, but far away from its shadows, side by side in their nameless graves, the lovers are sleeping under the humble walls of the little Catholic churchyard. In the heart of the city they lie, unknown and unnoticed. Daily the tides of life go ebbing and flowing beside them." thousands of throbbing hearts, where theirs are at rest and forever. Thousands of aching brains, where theirs no longer are busy. Thousands of toiling hands, where theirs have ceased from their labors. Thousands of weary feet, where theirs have completed their journey. Still stands the forest primeval, but under the shade of its branches dwells another race, with other customs and language. Only along the shore of the mournful and misty Atlantic linger a few Acadian peasants, whose fathers from exile wandered back to their native land to die in its bosom. In the fisherman's cot, the wheel and the loom are still busy. Maidens still wear their Norman caps and their curls of homespun. And by the evening fire repeat Evangeline's story, while from its rocky caverns the deep-voiced neighboring ocean speaks, and in accents disconsolate answers the wail of the forest. What made me post this podcast? I had a reason. It was because I saw in my photo folder a picture I had taken of a painting in the Detroit Institute of Arts. It was of that very moment when Evangeline saw Gabriel. It is very powerful and very touching. I decided to post it on Facebook for the benefit of anyone who perhaps did not know the story and had never seen the image. By the way, the painting is by Samuel Richards, and it's online if you want to see it. One of my former colleagues, someone roughly in my age range, said she read this poem as a girl and cries every time she sees the painting or thinks of this poem. I don't cry, but I have to admit that every time I think of that poem, I have a definite rush of emotion, as if I were in the eighth grade, and had just read that end. This poem has never left me, even after 65 or so years. Last weekend, I went to the library and checked out the collected works of Longfellow. I reread Evangeline for the first time since I was 14. It affected me. That night, I found myself lying there in bed, thinking about, well, just thinking. I know this poem would not fit within today's curriculum. There are big words in that poem. Words we kids had never heard, and we were expected to learn them. And there were deep lessons in that poem, lessons of grief and loss and injustice and tragedy. Today someone would object that it was too much for an eighth grader, or that it dwelt too much on injustice, or that slavery was never mentioned, or that it was not relevant to the lives of children today. But I keep thinking, I was not a Canadian. I was not French. I was not from Louisiana. I was not a refugee. I was not a female. And yet, this is a poem that makes retirees, educated, mature retirees, people who have published books and won awards, people like my colleague and me, it makes us tear up after six decades. I wonder what kids read today that will touch them 60 years from now when they think back. If not Evangeline, what? I hope there is something. Thank you for listening.